was something that stuck out so well. It's always going to be basically imprisoned in my mind for the rest of my life, and it has been for 14 years.
You look down into the valley.
Yep.
And there's a clearing.
There's a clearing.
With a UAP.
Yes.
Just sitting there.
Sitting there hovering. Rotating clockwise, yep. And that's in transition, this color spectrum I was telling you too.
So as far as from a distance, yes, that looks very accurate to what I saw. Rogue military force, if you will. The most concerning thing about this is they all had American dialects. They had American gear. They had OTVs, black. They had black camouflage. They had very similar setups to what we had, but more high speed, something what you would see special operation groups these days have. They had no insignias on.
And that's when I thought it was it. I thought they were going to smoke us, you know, and they kept saying that, you know, we can kill you right now. You know, they're as this is.
At the start of the year, I made a video titled The Marines Who Got Too Close to UFOs, where I talked about two whistleblower testimonies of men who encountered UAP throughout their military service in the USMC. And this included Jonathan Weygandt and, of course, Michael Herrera. And guys, I'll admit my biases. While I was really supportive of Jonathan Weygandt and found his story to be credible, I was really dismissive of Herrera. Now, for Michael Herrera, I'm torn on his story. I'm not sure about that. This all changed when Redditor and now my good friend, Joey is not my name, reached out to me and asked if I was the creator of this video. Joey told me that he had been investigating Michael deeply and that he and him had actually established a relationship and talked weekly.
I even left a paper trail with certain people, including Joey, who's not my name.
And there's been a person who has helped with that. Joey, that's not my name. You, if you're watching this, thank you for your help.
As more of a person, you know, who has broad attention to detail in a lot of things, which is remarkable. His Reddit handle is Joey is not my name.
And finally, he told me that he had enough evidence to attest to the fact that Michael met a man, an insider, in the Black Reverse Engineering Program. This brief exchange of messages led to a fast friendship between Joey and myself. And for months, actually, he and I have been talking every day, on messaging, video calls, and phone calls, discussing Michael's case. And throughout this time, he has shown me some of the astonishing evidence to both support Michael's claims of his experience in Indonesia and his experience meeting an insider in the Black Reverse Engineering Programs. So today, guys, I am thrilled to tell you that I actually have my good friend, Joey is not my name, on the show to talk about his experience investigating Herrera's case and discuss some of the evidence he's actually found to corroborate Michael. If you've never heard of Michael Herrera, I'd be shocked, especially after so much renewed interest in his encounter, after being all but named in the abomination that is the Arrow Historical Report Volume 1. But for those of you who don't know, or may need a quick refresher, let's briefly summarize Michael's UFO whistleblower encounter. And guys, please note, as I talk about Michael's testimony, I will be recounting it as fact, as told by Michael. The reality is, there is still no way we can prove with evidence that Michael encountered this UFO in the jungles of Indonesia. But we can prove with fact some of the context around Michael's story, such as the military mission in Indonesia and the relief effort by the USAF and Marines. In the summer of 2023, Stephen Greer's National Press Club event featured an array of whistleblower individuals, ranging from credible to somewhat dubious. One of these men was a USMC vet who seemed emboldened to break his 14-year silence, yet nervous to reveal himself to the public. It was here Michael Herrera first told his story to the world. In 2009, 2nd Battalion 5th Marine Michael Herrera, at this time a 20-year-old SAW gunner, was called into Indonesia for a human relief aid mission after the devastating Sumatra earthquake and tsunami. Michael was stationed on the USS Denver, which is oddly enough the name of both of our hometowns. This was the only ship routed to the west coast of Indonesia from the US 7th Fleet. In October of 2009, Herrera's unit was informed they would be providing security to aid in the delivery of food and medical supplies. And it's crucial to note, although humanitarian missions generally do not see soldiers equipped with weapons, the first Marines reportedly were, and in this case, M16A4s, due to the heavy presence of terrorist training in the area. Herrera's team arrived near Pandang from CH-53 Helos at a hasty LZ, where the team pushed to a high ground for reconnaissance purposes. And it's worth noting, and rightfully one of the biggest points of contention surrounding Michael's testimony, Herrera states his team was not equipped with radio comms, and Michael himself states this was highly abnormal. The team trekked up a ridge at an elevation of roughly 300 meters. Herrera had on him a Panasonic camera and was taking images of the surrounding area. Once the Marines reached the high point of the ridge, something, quote, stuck out like a sore thumb, end quote, against the jungle terrain. There was a craft rotating just above the tree line, transitioning colors between a light matte gray and a dark matte black. Perplexed, the team decided to approach and investigate, and it's key to note, Michael did in fact take pictures of the craft with the camera he stored in his spent magazine pouch. Reaching down the slope, the USMC team was about 150 meters from the craft. It was from here Michael estimated the craft to be 300 feet in diameter. It was octagonal in shape, rotating clockwise with Vanta black exterior panels and a pyramid-type shape on top. The craft let off an audible hum, almost like a guitar amp. The craft floated 15 to 20 feet above the ground, surrounded by a, quote, rogue military force. What was astounding is these men featured American dialects, American gear, and similar setups the Marines had, but with much better equipment. These men had no rank, no insignia. Eight of the men engaged the Marines, directing their weapons at the soldiers and flipping off the weapon safeties, screaming at the Marines, asking what they were doing there, and threatening their lives. Terrified, the Marines complied. They were patted down and stripped of their weapons. The rogue operators even knew to take the Marines' military IDs out of their left breast pocket, where they snapped pictures of Herrera and his fellow Marines' identifications. During this time, Michael occasionally shifted his glance back to the large UFO, where four F-350s sat with weapon cases and containers with an oxygen or humidity control unit, which held what Michael would later come to learn were human beings. The F-350s loaded the supplies onto a platform below the craft. When the platform itself rose from the ground, connected with the craft, and the two connected pieces shot off westward instantaneously. No rotor wash, no exhaust, no sonic boom, none of the surrounding vegetation was disturbed in any way. The Marines were told to turn around. Michael thought that this was it. They were dead. Until the operators began reloading the soldiers' equipment and magazines back onto their persons. Escorting the Marines back up to the slopes, the operators told Michael and his fellow soldiers they were not allowed to look back or talk about what they had seen. Breaking the hillside, the Marines ran back to the LZ, where a resident gunnery sergeant grew furious at the non-combat effect of Marines. Flying back to the USS Denver, an admiral debriefed the team, and a few days later, while on leave, the battery and SD card to Michael's camera were taken, along with the fellow Marine's cell phones. And finally, when the USS Denver tracked back to Okinawa, a man in USAF blues with no name tag pulled Michael into his office, where he told him to never tell anybody of his encounter regardless of chain of command. Discussing the event would lead to imprisonment or death. Michael was then forced to sign an NDA to never speak about the experience.
And what really triggered me into being motivated to look into the case myself was hearing all of the negative reaction towards him for reasons that I felt were really flimsy. You know, people were criticizing him because they didn't, you know, he said they didn't have radios, and or like because he mislabeled the name of a rifle or something. And I just thought that was pretty absurd to completely dismiss a whistleblower when you're literally sitting here considering a story about a 300-foot UFO, but because they didn't have a radio, that's too unbelievable for you, you know? So let's just dismiss the whole thing. If the UFO community did not have the open-mindedness and patience and space to provide a whistleblower to, you know, give time to investigate and vet the story, and if we were gonna just gonna shoot him down immediately for like really lame reasons, how are we gonna expect the general public to take this seriously if we can't even, you know, give it a chance, you know? So, I mean, the other thing was like, it dawned on me, like, this is a military operation and humanitarian operation. So there's a ton of photojournalism, journalists, you know, military reports and assessments that were done all around this operation. So I saw that as a great opportunity to begin digging into the details to see if I could find any conflicts with Michael's testimony. And I ended up finding the opposite, that I was corroborating everything that I could find corroborated what he was saying. Now, obviously, that doesn't prove he saw a UFO, but it does corroborate all of the details around that operation that he was on. And so I made a post on Reddit kind of, you know, detailing those things that I found.
Joey's first Reddit post, titled "Verifying the Events Around Michael Herrera's UFO Encounter Part 1, sought to confirm all the little bits and pieces of the military operation in 2009. Logically, if Michael could be found to be lying about any detail regarding the humanitarian mission, his whole testimony could be thrown out the window as another UFO wannabe. Joey provided documentable evidence to support all of the context Michael provided, including the USS Denver was the sole ship assigned to support Indonesian military efforts, regardless of Michael finding this strange. The 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit was present at this operation. CH-53 Super Stallion choppers were used to deliver aid. And finally, the confirmation of Hasty LZs through a blog post which detailed efforts done by the U.S. forces to deliver supplies to critical and remote areas. Of course, none of this actually proves that Michael saw a UFO whilst in service, but this post does confirm key smaller elements of his story, including accurately depicting the military op in Indonesia. Joey includes a call to action asking Michael to reach out for further investigation.
So my plan was to do a part two where I wanted to figure out where the landing zone was. And so I thought if I could reach out to Michael and we could work together to figure out where the landing zone was, I have a 3D modeling background. So what I wanted to do was import that terrain into, you know, some 3D modeling software and be able to perform like additional analysis to cross-check his estimates of distances and heights and scales of things. And I also thought it was important to illustrate the distances that are involved in this encounter, because the landing zone was almost 700 or 800 meters away from where the craft was sighted, with a hill in between, in the middle of jungle. And so that was really my only thought for reaching out to Michael. I had no idea it was gonna, you know, kind of spiral much deeper into what it has. I mean, how rare is it that we get any sort of testimony that's literally just it, you know, most times it's literally just testimony. It's just someone's verbal account of what happened. There's no evidence, there's no nothing. And here we have a military operation that has, you know, aerial surveys being conducted. I'm sure there's plenty of satellite imagery, you know, that exists, and just all of the different records that kind of track the movements of things. You know, it just, that reason alone seems like a very exciting case to dig into, where you have a lot of opportunity to uncover data. Literally that same day that I emailed him, he called me that night. We spoke for about a half hour, and you know, I got the sense that he respected the amount of effort I put into that post and just the, you know, just putting in the work. I have a feeling it was part of why he started to trust me and respect me moving forward. You know, he started trusting me with certain sensitive information that did help, you know, back up some of his claims, circumstantially, I'll say. Then he started telling me more about this insider.
The discussion around this program insider who met with and disclosed leaks to Michael is where some followers of this case, including myself, justifiably raise red flags and heighten their skepticism. But who is this insider, and for what reason did he meet with Michael? What can Joey tell us about this meeting, and how can he prove Michael was flown out to a secure facility to meet with this shadowy figure? And also, do not worry, when we get to the actual contents of the meeting, we will of course discuss all of the leaks that were told to Michael by this insider. Michael's first encounter with this insider was actually mentioned on his first public appearance on Stephen Greer's National Press Club panel.
Which, come to find out through recent revelations from yesterday from somebody who came forward to Dr. Greer, I don't know who they are, but what they had told him and what he has told me is that this gentleman knows exactly what these were used for, because they had like a cylinder on the front, which is either for oxygen or what I have hypothesized was for vacuum sealing, which believed me to suspect that they were smuggling narcotics or drugs. Come to find out it's more disturbing than that. This gentleman has firsthand account with this and says that it was for people.
This insider wanted to meet Michael in person. And so he asked Dr. Greer to make the connection. And so, you know, he introduced the two or passed along phone numbers or whatever. And so Michael's telling me all this, you know, that this insider wants to meet him and all this stuff. And I found it very suspicious. You know, I found it very strange that not only would he have this really incredible story about seeing a UFO in Indonesia, a huge 300-foot UFO, which is pretty unique. I don't know. I personally don't know of too many stories like that big. And now you're telling me that literally an insider wants to meet you? Like, come on, this is, you know, this is pretty outrageous, you know?
How did Michael react when he was approached by the insider? Was he excited? Was he skeptical? Was he possibly worried for his safety? Scared.
Yeah, he was, I mean, the last time, if you think about it, like the last time he's interacted with any of these people, they had guns pointed at him and, you know, were threatening to kill him and stuff. And so now here's someone, you know, allegedly associated with that. And, but he just felt like if he wants to move this forward, he's gotta take the chance and do it. And for me, you know, at the time, this was pretty early on in my interactions with Michael, and I didn't feel like I had the sort of relationship with him where I could, you know, ask questions or provide advice or anything like that. You know, I was basically just kind of respectfully, you know, taking information from him that he felt comfortable sharing with me. But I wanted to scream at him and say, dude, like, are you crazy? And mind you, I went back and forth constantly through this period where I would allow myself to pretend it's all real and, like, you know, let myself just kind of sit there for a minute and be like, all right, let's say this is all real. Holy crap, this is, he's crazy. Like, he can't go and meet this guy. He's going to kill him, you know? And then there were times where I would be feeling the opposite and being like, okay, this is clearly like a setup, and he's telling me stuff that he's telling me is sensitive, but in reality it's he wants me to leak it, but he's telling me not to. It's like reverse psychology or something, and you know, I need to be really cautious here. And so that was what was going through my mind at the time, and it was very much back and forth. But I also felt like I was in a pretty good position, because this wasn't anything I had to take action on. I had reached out to him to kind of like try to figure out where the LZ was, and then it kind of just snowballed into this other thing. But I felt like I was in a great position, because there was really no risk or harm in me just letting things play out and see what happens, you know?
Joey was rightfully extremely confused and skeptical as to why Michael confided so much information to him about the insider in the meeting time, date, and location. It was then Joey actually realized Michael was using him as a dead man switch. Michael feared what might happen to him, being taken out to an unfamiliar location by unfamiliar people, and in case he was in fact killed, Joey should release any and all information he had.
That was what made me the most suspicious, because it was like he was trusting me with information without any real justification. And then I realized, you know, that he was going out to meet this guy, and I got the feeling that he was, you know, telling me this information in case something happened to him. And I called him out on it and told, and, you know, he basically said, like, yeah, I, you know, if something happens to me while I'm out there, you know, I want you to release all this information.
I'm very happy that Joey brought this next point up, as he has never actually talked about this publicly. The day before the meeting, Joey and Michael had a conversation about the meeting, and Joey recorded this conversation without Michael's knowledge.
I called Michael and had a conversation with him about the meeting, and I recorded it without his knowledge. And I did that because I felt like I needed proof in case I did need to, in case something did happen to him and I couldn't get in touch with him, and I needed to reach out to someone to prove that, yes, I'm in touch with Michael and these are the things he's told me and now I can't get a hold of him. I didn't think anyone would believe me unless I had some sort of proof that I was talking to him. So I recorded that. I think I actually shared that with you. Hey, Michael.
Hey, what's up? I had a little time before I have to kick off this meeting here at 9:30.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I just, you know, first of all, I wanted to check in with you, see how you're doing, how you're feeling.
Good. Tomorrow's the meeting with these guys, so I'm kind of, you know, I'm nervous about it, a little apprehensive. But
right.
If this is going to get carried any further, then I need to, you know, I need to speak to the horse's mouth, so to speak. So I just, you know... It is what it is at this point, but
yeah.
It's fucking crazy.
Yeah. I'm just kind of checking in. I mean, like, geez. So everything's basically all set for the meeting.
Yeah. Tomorrow.
For tomorrow.
So I arrived there around 9:00.
Yeah.
Their time. And then they're picking me up with picking me up. They got all, they're putting me in. And
right.
Then I'm going to some, apparently there's a facility out and that they're taking me to, and then flight somewhere to go see some things. So I don't know what that entails, but
yeah. Okay. And then you're going to touch base with me afterwards at some point.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Michael, well, be safe, my friend, and look forward to touching base with you when you get back.
Roger that, man. Thank you for being involved with this too. And, you know, I'm glad that you're checking up on me.
Cool.
You know, it's great. So yeah, as soon as I get more information, if I'm able to release some things, after this meeting, then, I'll let you know.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, buddy. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
What stood out to me most about this conversation was the fear in Michael's voice. He sounded scared, like he didn't know what was going to happen to him. And yes, he did provide specific details. And also, Joey did tell Michael about this recording later on, so please don't hold that against him. Michael knows. But using this information provided by Michael, Joey was able to verify many of the details that Michael claimed. Think tracking flight records and such.
There's other evidence that I can't share publicly. I think I did share that, like some censored, a censored version of that evidence with you.
And guys, I have seen a lot of people dismiss or get on Joey's case for not sharing this evidence. He has in fact shown me a censored version of this evidence. And if Joey is telling the truth, which I believe he is, and showing me an undoctored version of this evidence, I can say with a high degree of certainty that this meeting did in fact take place. This isn't to say anything about what the insider showed or told Michael. I can't comment on that legitimacy, nor can Joey. We don't know. The evidence, of course, is not mine to share, or to an extent, even Joey's. There is a larger behind-the-scenes investigation here being conducted that, if shared publicly, could compromise the investigation, or at the very least, make it somewhat hairy. I personally hope that the finer details of this investigation and Joey's evidence will come to light soon.
I essentially was able to prove that Michael was taken to a secure facility, is how I refer to it, with this insider. And so for me, and the thing is like, I didn't have to rely on any trust of Michael. Like, I didn't have to rely, like, none of this is contingent upon me having to trust any word that any person has told me. This is objective data and evidence that I used to verify this. When he got back and we started talking, I didn't immediately reveal to him that I was able to track where he went. And so I used that opportunity to further vet and you know, criticize, but validate, you know, his account. So I was asking him specific questions about timing.
So at this location, Michael was both shown and told things by this insider. What was he shown?
He hasn't told me what he saw there. He said he signed an NDA.
So what was Michael told? Strangely enough, this insider was okay with Michael telling Joey and the greater public about what he was told at this meeting. Now, Joey and I are both a little apprehensive to discuss these points, as we cannot back these up with any evidence. However, it's important to discuss anyways.
I feel a little uncomfortable like going through kind of the speculative stuff that this insider has told Michael, because it's nothing I've been able to verify.
Well, according to this insider, he is an advocate for disclosure and has been in the program for decades. Remember guys, all of this is speculation. This could very well be purposeful disinformation by this insider or utter nonsense. But I want to talk about these statements due to the existence of the insider and the reality of the meeting. Fortunately, Joey has made a post on Reddit detailing this information, which will be on screen now and in the show notes. This is all content Michael has relayed publicly or given Joey permission to share. Within the USG, there are two groups studying UAP, the Blue Group and the Black Group. The Blue Group consists of programs with proper congressional oversight, think Arrow, ATIP, Blue Book, etc. Black Group is an organization founded in the 1940s to reverse engineer NHI tech. The lack of oversight, accountability, and endless reach of this Black Group mirrors almost identically what is spoken about in the Wilson-Davis memo. This Black Group has successfully reverse engineered NHI craft to an unknown degree of success, but utilizes these craft for operations. The flying crafts are considered, quote, boring tech. There are other technologies that are far more exciting and, in the insider's words, utilitarian for humanity. EMP-like weaponry has been developed that can target and disrupt and disable UAP. Crash retrieval programs are able to lure UAP to locations where they are disabled via the EMP weapons and craft and bodies are recovered. Now we get into some of the real woo and troubling stuff. The program recruits people with, quote, psionic abilities, end quote, referred to as P3, often from third world nations. These individuals are needed to interface with and control NHI tech. Recruits from these third world countries are often bargained with to join the program in exchange for security and safety of their families, likely due to the permanent or semi-permanent isolation of the recruits while in the program. This is the operation Michael stumbled upon in Indonesia. Many recruits actually die in the process of interacting with NHI tech, and this is due to heavy drugging to induce a calm meditative state. These recruits are treated like biological equipment. In order to fly some, interesting choice of words there, NHI craft, a consciousness connection must be made. A Black Program pilot cannot fly an NHI craft directly if he does not have the desired psionic abilities mentioned. So the program has devised a method to connect a recruit to a brain interface machine, where the pilot controls the machine to control the person's intentions, thus controlling the craft. If true, and this is a big if, the implications of this program existing are beyond disturbing. But let's try and keep investigating. What else can Joey tell us about this insider?
I do know that this insider is real, and I can say that because... I don't know how I can publicly acknowledge how I know that. I will say that there are other people who have corroborated the existence of this insider to me personally. I know that he took Michael to this location. And so due to what I know this location to be officially, it leads me to believe that this person has quite a bit of authority to be able to bring him to this location in the nature in which he did. Because my first question is like, how the heck does anyone get to bring a random person, Michael Herrera,
especially a civilian at the time?
For sure. Yeah. Like how, like that's impossible, right? Like there's gotta be all the security and like, you know, cross-checking and surveillance of like every person who's walking in and out of the place. And the way this all went down was just like, holy crap. He literally did that. So like, what are the implications of that? You know? So I know Michael was taken to this location and I know the insider exists. But I don't know if anything the insider is saying is true. So the insider has provided Michael with a lot of leaks, you know, information about the black program. He's specifically involved with the crash retrieval aspect.
So the question on my mind, and I'm guessing all of yours too, is why did this insider tell all of this to Michael? If this was a psyop, why bring Michael all the way to this black site and show him all this unknown stuff? And even if the insider is lying, this still does not account for Michael's experience seeing the UFO in 2009. That experience is not negated if this is a psyop. To me, both sides of the coin seem somewhat logical and plausible. I often think back to the story of Paul Benowitz, who in 1989 was driven to insanity by being fed false information about extraterrestrials by the CIA. This is a fascinating story I might cover one day because it's really worth knowing. On the other hand, if this figure is pro-disclosure but does not want to be public, it does make sense for him to use Michael as a vessel. Let's see what Joey thinks.
These guys don't want to come out publicly. You know, they have a lot at risk. Personally, they have no interest in being like public figures about this topic. There are allegedly a lot of factions within the program who aren't interested in this becoming disclosed. And so, you know, there's personal risk with that as well. And so I think, you know, he saw in Michael someone who was already comfortable with that risk of being a whistleblower. And because he had that connection of understanding the operation that Michael had witnessed, felt that he would be a good person to, you know, try to reach out to.
Something that raises suspicion about the insider for both Joey and myself is the story of a book. A few weeks after the meeting, the insider told Michael he was in the process of writing a book under a ghostwriter. The purpose of this book was to hide truth in fiction, similar to Secret Machines by Tom DeLonge. This book is titled Sentinels of Ether. What sticks out to me as concerning here is the book was framed to be corroborating evidence to support Michael's story. However, the connecting threads are thin at best. In fact, this book is about an event that occurred in Mexico in 2004, in which a paramilitary group in the Black Program wipe out an entire JSOC team during an operation. The Black Team is described as transporting humans inside shipping containers to a hidden base in a mountain, which is similar to the containers Michael Herrera describes in his encounter.
I didn't mention this earlier, but one of the things that Michael had been excited about with this meeting was he was supposedly going to be given some evidence that would support his claims, you know? And this is what that ended up being, was this book. Yeah, and I'm like, how is a fictional book supposed to corroborate anything, you know? And it's not even about the event that Michael saw, it's something completely different that happened.
The insider actually provided a 2-chapter manuscript of the book currently under Dopser review to remove classified information. In the insider's own words, he is playing a scheme or 4D chess on Dopser. And of course, for those of you who don't know, Dopser is the Defense Office of Pre-Publication and Security Review. This is what David Grush is currently going through with his op-ed right now, so he doesn't divulge any classified information.
And he does provide some context as to the sort of scheme that he's trying to play on Dopser, where he's intentionally, you know, including certain information that he knows you know, shouldn't be flagged by Dopser because it's like deep black projects that shouldn't be acknowledged, and he's trying to see if they'll catch it. And it, I don't know, it just sounds a little sketchy to be honest.
In fact, the insider directly quotes, quote, "Our intention is to put the DoD in a pickle by creating dilemmas. We are strategically taking advantage of the fact they must respond. They don't have a choice, no poker face. Any response will provide us with information / intelligence and inverse intelligence." One of the other things that Joey has more information on than almost anybody else are the thoughts and words of Michael's fellow platoon members who were with him in Indonesia in 2009. According to the original Daily Mail article that was written on Herrera, the other four or five Marines in Herrera's platoon were too scared to come forward, bar one text message that read, quote, "Hey man, this is asking too much of me. It's not worth the risk. My family and military career far exceed anything you are asking of me. It's not worth my life or jeopardizing my family. I know we go back, but this is asking too much. You need to get out of whatever you are in and don't get me involved."
So I've talked to a handful of people who were in his platoon and were on that mission, on that ship, I would say. Not the UFO mission, the alleged UFO mission, but I'll say, you know, the Indonesia relief effort mission or operation. I will say that out of those people that I have spoken to, all of them believe Michael is lying. Except for one. There's one person that I've reached out to and asked for permission to ask some questions about it, and he just said no thank you and leave my name out of everything. But everyone else thinks Michael's lying. But the thing that's interesting is, you know, once I get into conversation with these people, they quickly reveal that, you know, because someone says very strongly, "I know he's lying." My follow-up question is, "Oh, so you were boots on the ground with him in Indonesia?" And their reply is, "Well, no, I was in a different squad," or, "Oh no, I stayed on the ship. I didn't leave the ship." And so immediately I'm like, "Well, you can't possibly know he's lying because you weren't there. Like, how can you say you know he's lying?" So, you know, that was really disappointing to hear. However, I still maintained conversations with these people because they did, you know, certain people provided some, you know, personal photographs that I was able to, you know, there was nothing crazy in the photographs, but it did prove that they were in, you know, the Tabing airport where the coordination efforts were happening. But there's one person who I do find very credible, who speaks against Michael. I'll just say his first name. His name's Nathan, and he was Michael's team leader, and he provided. So I've had several, you know, text conversations with him, and he provided a photograph, that he alleges shows Michael and another Marine on a helicopter. And he says they're all being flown into Indonesia. They don't have rifles, right? This photograph is important because if it is proven to be Michael, it kind of shows that he's lying about, something, you know, or, you know, most of the story gets kind of discredited because, you know, the big part of Michael's story was he had rifles and, you know, he was with different people. So Michael, you know, I did share that photograph with Michael. I didn't give him any context. I just said, do you know who's in this photograph? And he provided two names, and, you know, then I explained, you know, that the allegations that one of the people is him, and he denies it. He very strongly denies it. And what's interesting to me, to kind of play towards Michael in a way, let's say Nathan's telling the truth. Let's say Michael did fly in with him without rifles. And let's say Michael was on that flight, right? What that would mean, if he is lying about this UFO thing, that means he was thinking, let me make up a story about a UFO, But also let me lie in about a mission I know I went on with my squad, even though he knows there were witnesses and he knows, you know, his photo is being taken. That just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, why would he... Like, he could have very easily just said, yeah, that is me in the photograph, but I also took a different flight in later on or earlier in the day. You know, he could have made it so... He could have just acknowledged that both things are true and it would have totally negated that photographic evidence.
The question of rifles or lack thereof in Nathan's alleged photograph is crucial. Since Indonesia 2009 was a humanitarian mission, Marines were not supposed to be equipped with rifles. As I stated earlier, and what was actually confirmed to Joey by all the Marines he spoke to, the first wave of Marines in Indonesia were in fact armed, but subsequent deployments were not due to bad optics. Allegedly, an Air Force colonel yelled at the Marines and ordered them to stop utilizing rifles. And now the reason why probably half of you are watching this video with a renewed interest in Michael Herrera, the Aero Historical Report Volume 1. Within this report, Michael Herrera is all but named as somebody who testified to Aero, stating, quote, "An interviewee who is a former U.S. service member said in that 2009, while participating in a humanitarian and security mission in a foreign country, he encountered U.S. Special Forces loading containers onto a large extraterrestrial spacecraft." And guys, I probably don't need to explain this to you, but Aero Historical Report Volume 1 is not the most accurate report we've ever seen. In fact, in this 2-3 sentence summary of Michael Herrera, there are two factual inaccuracies. One, Michael never claimed he encountered U.S. Special Forces. What he said was he encountered men with American dialects, with American gear, but no rank, no insignia, no identifiers to where they belonged. And two, Herrera said, even from his first statement, he thought the craft he saw was human reverse engineered, not extraterrestrial. Is this just awful writing or purposeful disinformation? I lean more towards purposeful. I think this is so bogus and just, in a two-sentence summary, getting so many facts wrong. In my opinion, this sort of misreporting is on purpose and a symptom of the larger sickness that is this report. And I just want to touch on what seems to be a big misconception in the UAP community on Twitter and Reddit at the moment. On page 32 under the section, "The UAP with Peculiar Characteristics" refers to an authentic non-UAP related SAP. Some people are confusing this statement as describing Michael Herrera. In the statement, it says Aero was able to correlate this account with an authentic USG program because the interviewee was able to provide a relatively precise time and location. As first pointed out to me by Joey, Michael narrowed down the timing of the event to within a couple days, but he did not know the precise time, and Michael did not know the exact location of the landing zone in Indonesia. In the same section, whatever person was writing this Aero report stated that "The seemingly strange characteristics reported by the interviewee match closely with the platform's characteristics, which was being tested at a military facility in the time frame." The interviewee was there. But again, as Joey points out, Michael's encounter occurred in a remote part of the jungle in Indonesia, not a military facility. What was massively vindicating to Joey, and something that made him place more trust in Michael, and he even relayed this to me, months before the Aero Historical Report Volume 1, Michael had actually told Joey and provided him proof that he had testified to Aero.
He said that they didn't record his testimony. Like, they weren't actually, like, electronically recording his testimony. There were just people in a skiff, and some of them had notepads and were just, like, taking notes occasionally. So the summary of his testimony in the report could literally just be the result of poor note-taking. And I am perfectly comfortable with accusing them of doing this intentionally because, you know, it certainly seems like something that they were trying to prevent as much of a paper trail as possible, and leaving a lot of the records up to interpretation. And I think that was 100% intentional. So I don't know if it was a malicious misquoting of Michael or just literally poor note-taking and someone read someone else's notes and kind of summarized and misinterpreted or whatever.
Did he testify to Dr. Kirkpatrick or was it just Arrow employees?
He says it was directly to Dr. Kirkpatrick was in the room, yeah. But another thing that I'll mention as well, something I kind of caught was, you know, speaking of that statute that would, you know, provide penalties to anyone who lies, I noticed that Arrow was extremely careful in their report not to accuse a single whistleblower of lying or misleading. They emphasized how, you know, accepting they are of the fact that they these whistleblowers believe what they're telling Arrow. You know, and I think, again, I think that was incredibly intentional. It was really like the first kind of opening sort of statement in the report. If you really kind of highlight the key words there, it's literally all about belief. Yeah. And just emphasizing belief, and everyone's entitled to their belief, and they, you know, we can't criticize or hold it against anyone if they believe something, and that was intentional so that nobody could, you know, I previously asserted that, you know, Arrow would be forced to prosecute if they lied, but that's not really the case. I kind of misspoke there. Really, I think it would have made an opportunity for other lawyers or organizations to press charges against whistleblowers if they had lied, and Arrow would be kind of in a position potentially to provide evidence that supports that assertion. So they wanted to make sure to avoid that at all costs, and that's why they did that, you know.
Of course, I was fascinated to know if Michael had spoken to any other whistleblowers or people behind the scenes. While Joey understandably couldn't comment, he did tell me something interesting that kind of made me jump for joy.
I do know that he has spoken to Jonathan Weygandt, which was pretty interesting, because they did have sort of similar experiences. So that was really cool to think that, you know, Jonathan kind of had gotten the chance to speak with someone else that, you know, had a similar experience.
I personally believe it is probable that Michael and Weygandt encountered the same insider paramilitary group. Too many similarities to men with American dialects and all black gear that appear to have highly skilled backgrounds. Of course, in Weygandt's case, he did specifically see men in DOE rain jackets, which allowed me to conclude that these are likely a DOE NEST team. Again, watch that analysis in my Marines video, and then listen back to Michael's testimony and cross-reference the two teams. And lastly, guys, I kind of wanted to touch on some of the criticism that Joey has received. He has received so much support for his investigation, but also a lot of hate online. People calling him Michael's shill, people calling him Michael's publicist, or even Michael under a pseudonym. And understandably so, he's received some flack for receiving evidence, yet not making it public. Let's see what he has to say.
I'm in no way his publicist.
Yeah.
I there's a few exceptions to that where there were people that I felt would be good people to interview him. One of them is Chris Leto. So that was a case where I reached out to Chris and kind of made the first contact and then introduced him. I just hope people will be open to continuing to just follow, you know, more as the story unfolds, because it's a very interesting case, because you not only do you have this historical event that happened in 2009 that still has a ton of data that is yet to be uncovered. Even by myself, you know, yes, there's things that I do have privately that I can't share, but there's also, you know, other data that hasn't been uncovered by myself or anyone. But now we have this kind of current thing that's unfolding as we speak. I mean, there are things happening right now behind the scenes as we speak. So I think it's incredibly interesting and worth paying attention to. And, you know, no one has to make a decision about whether they think it's true or false at this point. I've been taking this a lot more seriously than I ever did previously, and I am giving the benefit of the doubt to the other people involved behind the scenes. And I am taking them very seriously, and I'm respecting anybody's request for me not to reveal certain information, because that's just the right thing to do. And people criticize me, and it kills me, because I totally understand the criticism. I can't even argue the criticism, because I did make the decision to kind of have this compromise where I'd reach out to people like yourself and other, you know, podcasters and journalists and people who I trust, and, you know, reveal my identity. You know, you and I, we've had video calls, you've seen my face, you know who I am. And I've shared some information with you that backs up some of my evidence shared some of my evidence that backs up my opinions on certain things. And so really, that's the best compromise I could come up with, you know, for now. I do hope to get to a point where I can be public and share more evidence. But for right now, that was kind of the best compromise I could come up with.
And one last thing I'd like to touch on is the connection between Michael Herrera and Stephen Greer. I've touched upon this in almost every single one of my videos where there is a whistleblower, even my Marines video because of Jonathan Weygandt. So if you're interested to hear more, go check any of those out. But I think it's important to start separating the whistleblowers from Dr. Greer. It's no surprise I have my problems with Dr. Greer, but I'm trying to take an approach where I will individually vet whistleblowers and people separate from Greer. I see a lot of people saying that these two are in cahoots, which is just blatantly not true. In fact, Michael himself has said that Dr. Greer has embellished or purposefully lied about details of his story.
There's been some interviews that Dr. Greer has done and everything like that, where he's told people that they put guns right to our head. That wasn't the case. These guys were at a standoff distance, because it's easier to go like this than actually be at a standoff distance and try to rush somebody who has had a good distance that can sight in and just shoot you.
So we need to understand that Dr. Greer is probably one of the only avenues whistleblowers have to come forward that they know of before David Grush. Hopefully things change in the future and people start pursuing the avenues of Grush or maybe Carl Nell, or maybe if there's some changes, Arrow. But it's important to kind of separate Herrera from Greer. Hey guys, thank you so much for watching today. I hope you enjoyed this longer deep dive into Michael Herrera featuring Joey Is Not My Name. This video and a subsequent follow-up have been a long time coming, as since my first video, Joey and I have become very good friends and talk almost daily. So I would like to thank him for trusting me with some of the more sensitive evidence regarding Herrera. This case is ongoing, and I don't imagine there's going to be just one follow-up video he and I make to this. Michael Herrera's case has almost consumed me of late. I think about it all the time, I study it all the time, and I talk to Joey about it all the time. So this case is so fascinating to me. I can't believe I initially brushed it off by buying into the Greer hate or buying into some of the kind of nonsensical thoughts of just diminishing his testimony and thinking he's phooey because of some details that seem odd at first when hearing about his story. I am still torn on the insider in terms of, is this guy conducting a psyop or telling Michael real information? I just don't have enough evidence right now to know. But what do you guys think? After hearing some more of this video and hearing from Joey, do you guys believe more in Michael or less? Has his credibility increased or decreased in your eyes? I'd love to hear from you guys, because this case is so fascinating to me. Please guys, remember to like and subscribe. And if you're interested in supporting the channel, I have made a Patreon. It's in the channel description. I will not paywall any of my content, so only support what you think the channel deserves. Whether you decide to support with money or just watch my videos, I love you from the bottom of my heart, and I cannot thank you enough for being here and being a member of this community. Please, guys, remember to like and subscribe, and thank you so much. Join me for more videos and more appearances from Joey. So thank you, guys. I'll catch you next time.